So, good evening. So last week I was in the Netherlands for a White Plum meeting, and there were about 45 teachers from the lineage of Maizumi Roshi. And no one, except one person online, I think if I recall correctly, no one was from the first generation of teachers. So it was hosted by Tenke, who is the second generation. Roshi was there too, so second generation. And Chosin Beis, who was a direct successor of Maizumi, was present, but only online. So there's one generation that is really getting out of the picture. Bernie passed away. Genpo is not part of Genpo Roshi is not part of White Plum anymore. Nicole McMahon is more or less retired, and she has health issues, or her husband has health issues. So anyway. One question that was the thread of the meeting was, what was Maizumi's legacy, and how do we convey Maizumi Roshi's legacy? What do we do with it? One question that was kind of given to us was, in a way, to summarize all that, was, what is the point? What is the point? It's a pretty good question. It's a pretty broad question. It's a pretty deep question. Good evening, Anna. Yeah, so what is the point? That question during this weekend kept being asked, and in a way it was almost like a pretext to talk about, what do we do, what are we facing, what difficulties are we facing as teachers, what is the most important? This is what is written. What is written in the back of my rakusu, which is a quote from Shunryu Suzuki: "The most important thing is to remember the most important thing." But the question is, what is the most important thing, or what is the point, to go back to that question? So I've been pondering on that since then, since I arrived there on Friday, and since we had the first meetings. So that question was really on my mind, and it reminded me of many Dhamma talks I've heard from various teachers, and including Emi Roshi, where sometimes the teacher would stop on one word or one expression, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. And it's like that, and then it's, oh, but that's the whole practice. Well, this is the practice, right? This is our whole practice. And the funny thing is, it changes. Sometimes it's love, sometimes it's just this, sometimes various ways to express it. I remember a couple of months ago, maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago, someone one evening, a newcomer, asked me, if you had to say one word for the whole practice, what would you say? And the word that came up was freedom. for me. But as I was really diving into that question of what is the point, hi Debbie. It's just to sum up, I was just to so that you can catch up. I was reflecting on the question that was given to us during the White Plum meeting, which was, what is the point? And so I was thinking, I've been thinking about that, and I've been what came up for me was that it's really interesting to look at the varieties of answers also from the point of view of the history of Buddhism. And also, I mean, as I said, we've heard, all of us heard many times something that seemed to, like a word that seemed to capture the point of the whole practice. And however, these words are always different, and these words kind of point to various directions. And sometimes they are, I mean, obviously they are linked to one another. And yet, they also express various facets of the practice. And the history of our tradition is really deep. I mean, really goes way back. And obviously, there were many ways to express. And maybe, yeah, maybe ways to express things that are maybe slightly different. So I was thinking the first thing that came up to mind is if we look at really ancient, kind of the oldest text of the Pali Canon, it's in a way, it's pretty straightforward. However, I'm not even sure that what is supposed to be straightforward, like we could say the Buddhist orthodoxy of the Four Noble Truths, was even what the Buddha taught. I mean, we could even, following Stephen Batchelor, we could even question that. Is it really the way he expressed it? Which is basically, diagnosis, we all know that there's a suffering rooted in anger, ignorance, hatred, greed, and in order to move away from this suffering, we need to move away from and we need to eradicate greed, anger, and ignorance. And that when that extinction arises, there's a Nibbana extinction, and we do not live any longer in this cycle of birth and rebirth. I'm not even sure myself that I've always doubted that possibility to eradicate suffering. It doesn't make any sense to me, this idea of the Buddhist orthodoxy. I cannot relate to the Buddhist orthodoxy of extinction of desire, so that I don't. There is no rebirth anymore. It doesn't speak to me at all. What does speak to me is an understanding of the cycle of reactivity and getting freed, moving away from cycles of reactivity, so that I have more spaciousness and I'm less reactive and I'm more free to move in the world. That makes much way more sense to me. Then I was thinking of Dogen, and in the Shobogenzo, when he says, in a way, the whole point is to study the ways to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. So there is something of a letting go that is involved in there, in this study, in this knowing ourselves, getting to know and dropping. And maybe contrary to ancient Buddhism, there is something way less of a progression, in the sense that Dogen also insists of the fact that we're not really trying to achieve anything here, because sitting is already actualizing the way. So when we sit, we are already there. We're already seeing it. We're already actualizing the way. Going back to ancient Buddhism, what touches me very much, I was that also came up when I was thinking about all that, is there is a sutra that takes place when the Buddha is about to die or is dying, and Ananda is kind of very worried, about the that he gets the last drop of his teacher's teachings, and a little bit worried probably not to have guidance anymore. And when the Buddha Shakyamuni is being asked, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with myself when you're not there? This is a question that maybe Bernie could have asked to Maizumi if Maizumi had known that he was about to die. And what the sutra says, which I find very interesting, he says, "Dwell with yourself as your own island." And sometimes the word island is also translated as lamp. So be a lantern. Dwell with yourself as your own island or your own lamp, yourself as your own refuge, with no other refuge, with the Dharma as your island, the Dharma as your refuge, with no other refuge. So there's like this, dwell with yourself as your own island. There's a trust, a complete trust. And that trust is also, it's just not just like, okay, it's just about my own ego and I'm by myself, I'm an island in itself. It's really, the guidelines are basically the Dharma. And I think, by asking that question in this teacher's meeting, it was really, that question was really pointing back to our own experience. And for all of us, depending on the context, depending on our situations, there was a diversity of experience, and yet maybe there was something in common in all that. And I'm thinking I've received an email from Ineke Sensei, that we invited once, the person who did something about the women's ancestors. I don't know if you remember, she has a chronic illness. And so she was online and she was lying. She cannot really stand straight for a long time. And this is how she's using the Dhamma. That's her condition, chronic illness. And this is what she does with the Dhamma. This is how she dwells in herself as her own island, as her own refuge. And she uses this to teach the Dhamma. Other situations, there was this young guy who is taking over as the abbot of Great Vow Monastery in Oregon, and they're running a monastery there with monks and priests and the whole thing. And he's also going back to Japan to get trained in the forms. And there is something about authenticity. There is last year during that same meeting, I do remember that one of the things that came up when we were trying to find out what was so specific or so singular in the White Plum lineage and in all the successors of Maizumi in the way they transmitted was maybe I did mention that several times, the heart and that flavor of intimacy and an expression that was being used is the warmth of a grandfather, or grandfatherly warmth, something like that. And maybe this is this is the actualization of the way. One manifestation of that for Maizumi Roshi and hopefully all his heirs. One tension that I see, tension might be a wrong, not necessarily adequate, but or at least maybe the way it's formulated may seem slightly different. It seems to me that in the Pali Canon there is a strong emphasis on ethics and interpersonal relationships. And it's very structured. It's very clear that it's an ethical path. It may be less clear when, and yet I'm absolutely convinced that it's just there. It's just not necessarily as explicit, but when we read the koans, the emphasis is so much more on the direct experience, and at the same time, the direct experience is the perspective of the direct experience is the response, so it becomes the interpersonal dimension of the direct experience. Most of you work with Amy Roshi, and I've always liked this thing with her, with when we do a koan. So the question that comes after the koan, so in your life, how does it manifest? How does it manifest? How does it play out when we move around in the world, and so obviously when we move around with others, when we interact with others? I think there might be a slight bias when we read a lot of these koans, because a lot of them were they were addressed to monks, and so a lot of them had to also do with the training in just being present and being able to just have a direct experience right here, right now, and to drop the mind. Maybe less so with the various dimensions of what was going on in the monastery. There was a focus, but that doesn't mean that it's not there. That doesn't mean that the interpersonal dimension is not present. To me, Bernie Glassman is a great example of how it plays out, that interpersonal dimension, and how it worked for him. And he also followed his interests. He followed his heart. He became, you know, his own refuge. To go back to this quote from the sutra. And the Dharma was being expressed with his social activism.
You were saying that the interpersonal was present in the koan, in the sense that when there is a response to our teacher, and at the same time, how it manifests in our life, is that?
Yeah, that's. Yeah, yeah. I think that's what I say. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But you know, I mean, as you've experienced, the koans are very different from one another. From, you could say they're all the same, but they also tackle various angles. You know, and to me, it seems to me that it's a wonderful tool in order to really drop, you know, all our preconceived ideas and just really learn to be present. But then it's like, yeah, so what? You know, how does it, it's true that the question that is being asked, that we are asked by Roshi at the end, is like so crucial. So it's like, how does it play out in your life? That's what matters, really. You know, and not just, I mean, we don't. None of us live in a hermitage where we don't see anybody. So obviously, it plays out in the realm of the interpersonal.
Right. So maybe from what you were saying, it seems that first question of the most important point, or I don't recall how do you say it. The koan points to that, but at the same time, it seems to freedom of to awakening of to awakening to our own true nature or self or whatever. But at the same time, it seems that you are saying that join with that, it's the how it actualizes in the question of Amy and Roshi. Okay, how do it manifest in your life? So it kind of it's not two movements, but you awaken at the same time. How do you actualize this in your life?
Yeah,
And
that's how the koan is checked, you know. That's really how the koan is checked, and so that we make sure it's not an intellectual process, not just an intellectual process.
what I'm saying at the same time is that this most important point, there's a kind of at least these two dimensions of awakening and actualizing it inseparably.
Well, that's the thing of Dogen. It's like one, you know, it's like you actualizing by just doing it, you know, and there's no gradual process. And I mean, we during in the study groups weeks ago, we did study that, you know, that tension, what does it mean, you know, this gradual and sudden awakening, you know. And yeah. I don't know. It's I find it very fruitful to ask oneself, what's the point? And or why do I do it? But what's the point? And you know, in the context of also in a teacher's meeting, is like we're supposed to share this practice, but what is this? What is going on? You know. And it's funny because again there's no single and definitive answer to it, to that question. Or let's put it that way, we can express this in many ways. Thus this this seemingly confusing impression maybe at times that it you know that we there seems to be various points. And I also do feel sometimes that we can stop there. We just like we say one word. It's like it's about love, I've been listening to I've done a lot of traveling recently, going to the Netherlands and then going back to going driving south to Arles. So I was listening to a lot of podcasts about philosophy, and. And I listened to several podcasts on Diogen and on the cynics and on the you know on Nietzsche and you know different philosophers. And they each time I was thinking, yeah, it's you know, oh yeah, it's a little bit like us, you know, oh yeah, it's a little bit like us. And yet at the same time, I was like, well, I mean, it cannot be all the same, and there are differences, and. We do share maybe a movement, but there is a coherence in each of these paths. One aspect to me that seems very important is the praxis dimension, the fact that it's precisely unlike certain philosophies, it's like we have a number of exercise of practice, of training that helps us to really transform something in our functioning, in our inner functioning that goes very deep. And it's not just understanding something from an intellectual point of view. And to me, that really stands out. That really stands out. And what also really stands out is that the embodiment of this interpersonal dimension, or the realm of the ethical, and I think there is something that really, there is a common thread, whatever Buddhist traditions we're following, there's always this emphasis on how could I say that? The way we are in this together, all of us. It's not just me and how I'm going to save my ass. From the start, it's there. Whether it takes the form of, the bodhisattvas, that this idea, I mean, this imagery of the bodhisattva that really just stay there to help others, or the expression of this loving kindness, and it's the four vows are shared in, I guess, in most Buddhist traditions. Different translations, however, but it's really, it runs deep. It really runs deep. And that's also, if we were to limit, sum up Maizumi Roshi's, as we do sometimes, by the title of his book, Appreciate Your Life, and think, oh yeah, it's just appreciate my life. So it's some kind of egoistic hedonism. It's not that at all. Obviously, it's not that at all, because we're missing this. We would put away this grandfatherly warmth towards others that he was manifesting. Apparently, I've never met him, but that's what people were sharing. So yeah, I still stick to this word of freedom that I like very much. However, if I had to unpack, I know that this freedom for me is like, oh yeah, that's the starting point for, at the same time, the arrival and the starting point, like it's okay, freedom means non-reactive, being less reactive, being more free to move and all that, but also to connect and to interact and to move in this world and to flourish, to use Stephen Batchelor's terminology, to flourish as a human being. That speaks to me. And along the way, you could add all these virtues, of loving kindness, benevolence, all these aptitude qualities. Mindfulness and being focused and being collected and being absorbed, and the ability to be mindful and concentrated, and so that it manifests in appropriate speech, appropriate action, it is hard to sum it up in one word. a one sentence. So sometimes, as the text we one of the texts we studied recently in the study group, and sometimes so we have to say some things to how do you say to déployer to how do you say that to unravel, yeah, something like that, to explicit. Yeah.
New inward is, or maybe it's not even new anymore. Unpack.
Unpack, yes, unpack. Yes, unpack. It's very important to unpack, I feel. And these questions allow us to unpack, you know, what is the point? What is the most important thing? What would you say? We need to say something to unpack our experience, and really just trust. Yeah, this is what I could share, and yeah, it was a beautiful meeting. And one thing that struck me very much, that really kind of for me came out in the last day and after all these conversations, which I thought was kind of encouraging and such a relief to see that even, you know, teachers that had taught for like 30 years, 40 years, whatever time they've been teaching, they're still unsure. They're still walking with humility on this path, you know, trying out new things and not really knowing exactly what is going on, making mistakes sometimes. Yeah. And that was also another expression or another actualization. What is the point? To move in life with this ability to just be unsure and be open and not convincing ourselves that we know. So that we can be surprised, we can appreciate. We can be astounded by what is going on, by the people we meet. So, really, that hesitation or that not knowing is also another expression of this point, another actualization of this point. What is the point? Yeah, so I'll stop here if you want to. share what is your point, or what you see as the point, or if you have questions or anything. Yeah, Debbie.
I couldn't tell if Claudia wanted to talk or not. No. Okay. Yeah, this is one of my favorite subjects. And in the beginning, in the early years in Vimoutiers, first time I did sessions and it went on for day after day, I told myself, I'm still pretty sure it was part of it, that these 11th, 12th century monks were, this was the beginning of psychoanalysis in a way, because I got flashes of memories from my childhood in Vimoutiers while everybody else was doing their koan or whatever. I got advertising from when I was 4 and 5 years old from early American TV. I get the whole jingle in my head, just go zap. So you say Jacks, bum bum da bum, and I was like, what in the world is this? I mean, memories that came up that I didn't, I mean, they weren't particularly important, but they were fun. That's what these guys were. They had tapped into the same thing that happens in a good analysis. Quiet down and see, find out about yourself. I'm quoting this from some Deshi Maro, so I always assumed it's true, maybe it's not, that their definition of shikantaza was know yourself. Is that what shikantaza means? Or it's what it gives birth to in any case? Because, I mean, that for me, that's the point. I don't know what's the point of anything, but that's the richness of the experience, is to be able to. Sometimes it's kind of disappointing to find out who I am or how I act or whatever is in my head, but to be able to have access with in a safe environment, to have access to different aspects of my conditioning, training, whatever, that I would never have without the practice, without the sangha, without a good teacher. I think it would be impossible, really. And I've done a lot of psychoanalysis. To me, this is a great accompaniment. Is it stronger? I don't know if it's necessary to compare them. And saying this, I remember I told you this, Joa, because, and now I have a new friend who asked me pretty much the same question. You've been doing this all the time. What's the point? When I said to that woman that she came for a while, she said, what am I doing this for? And I said, oh, well, you get to know yourself. She said, I don't want to know myself. Whoops. So, different strokes, different folks. But for me, that's the big charge. I mean, myself. No, at least, I mean, just on a very superficial level, what am I doing when I think I'm walking down the street? As Amy was saying the other day at the day of practice, walk down the street. And oh, that reminds me of this, and was that building there, and all that. Well, I don't need to tell you all you practice, all this psychobabble that goes on 24/7, to come in touch with it is just, I don't know, I just find it such a moving experience, really.
And in Dogen's sentence, with there's to study the self, the second part of the sentence is to drop the self also. Okay, so it's not just wow, me, and I'm just but it's also that second phase when we really drop the self, and then the also what comes after is the realm of the impersonal in a way, to be awakened by all things and myriads of things. I forgot how he expressed it. So there are several dimensions in there. And so shikantaza is not just to know, it's to also not to know, to dwell in the unknowing also, is really to be present 100%, 36, 360 degrees. The awareness is completely open. And in that space, also, when sound is just sound, there's no you in there anymore. And it's not a mystical experience in a way. It's a very liberating experience also, not to be caught up by, yeah, that movie that plays out in front of our eyes about us, you know.
But no, I mean, not to push a point, but to forget yourself, you have to find out, at least in my case, who are we talking about? Because there's a lot of, I mean, in all different contexts, maybe even in mindfulness, oh, letting go. Yeah, but letting go of what? And I feel, I can see myself sometimes kind of faking it. What exactly, until I get to know what I'm messed up about, there's no point in saying, oh, I'll just let go. Well, yeah, good luck.
And also that's, thinking about this among the last sentence of of Shakyamuni, when he says you have to be an island for yourself, it's like there's an idea that I am an island, be an island, so there's it's not just things got totally dissolved either.
Can I
But
ask you one?
knowing that it's knowing that having the experience that it's a narrative, that someone is actually caught up in a narrative, that I am my narratives, and I'm clinging to my narrative. But when you see the narrative, not my narrative, but the narrative just unfolding in front of your eyes, and you're like, that's just a narrative. That's, you know what I mean, Debbie? That's when, and I'm very uncomfortable, maybe like you, with the letting go thing. With what I'm very uncomfortable with the letting go is that I am not so sure that every time is it's a decision from our will. It's a volitional act. Like I decide to let go. It's more like to me, it seems to me that most of the time it's letting go is actually happening. But it's not I decide to let go. It's like someone who would say to you, oh, just you're obsessed with something. Don't be. Well, thank you for saying this. It's not because I decide not to be obsessed with something or having obsessive thought that suddenly I don't have the obsessive thought. It's not how it works. So there's a training there to actually make to create the condition that the letting go is actually happening. But I'm not that sure it's a decision from simply I want it, I want this, That makes sense? That's your also your experience?
Personally, I'm not sure how it works, but it's I can't. I'm too confused. I'll be back.
For me, it's as I understand it, the point. It's not the point that we don't know. I think it's how to unpack or how to express it, how to actualize it. Because The point, although we can say it in a sentence, it's always the same. Like awakening to the unborn, to the unconditioned, to whatever we call it, the selfless nature. And how to express it and live it in the self of the human nature. It's what we don't know. I think it's the way I see this, and the letting go. It's for me. It's like it's the practice, and it's the passage from studying the self to forgetting the self. And then this is just a kind of putting things and then we even let go of letting go, because if not, we continue to assume a self that it's letting go of something, and it just is what it is. It's no point in continuing to let go. There's nothing to let go. It's just already it. Of course, this when we arrive there, sometimes most of the time, just let go. Okay, we have 3 or 4 more minutes.
Yeah, it remind I can't not stop of thinking of the three tenets of Bernie Glassman, unknowing, not knowing, bearing witness in action. And the third aspect is so important. How do we, it's like going back to your question, it's like, okay, well, then what? What do we do? What do we do? What do we do with it? What do we do from it? From, okay, now that I've seen it, what do we do? I find it really interesting that he used to, I mean, that's his way, that Bernie's way to, that was Bernie's way to express, the point.
Even the Buddha stopped in silence after awakening. Just, I don't know what to say. I don't have nothing to say.
Yeah, and then he realized he had to say something, and that was also pushed by, according to the story, pushed by the desire to help people, pushed by the love that he had for people, and we have to say something. And I love his first encounters, his first two encounters where he's trying to say something, and it's a complete failure. That's also very funny. That's just like the two first encounters, like one guy is he's saying how wonderful it was and all that, and the guy's like, well, good for you, bye.
Okay, should we
Right,
stop here?
yeah, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.